Everybody, welcome to another episode of the Three Questions. I am talking to one of the best people in show business.
True.
Also, one of the smallest egos in show business. The amazingly talented and wonderful and magical Paget Brewster.
It's me, Andy.
It's you. We have not seen each other in a long time because the world has conspired against us.
Mm-hmm. And but we've Zoomed.
We have.
I've seen you.
We have. We did, we did some pandemic fundraisers. We did a table read for Andy Richter Controls the Universe, which just recently had the 20th anniversary of its premiere, which is cuckoo.
Insane.
Cuckoo bananas. Mm-hmm. But I'm so glad you could do this. I'm so happy that you could come on here and chew the fat for an hour. And because I miss you in my life. Boy, you know, I tell people all this the time. I tell people this all the time. I said, having Paget Brewster around is like having a USO show going on at all times.
What does that mean?
Because she's always there to entertain the troops. You are all, and you were that. That was the way that you were when I worked with you. Is that you were always just like a ray of old timey show business sunshine? Of like, hey fellas, what's going on? You know, have a coffee and a donut. It was so appreciated. I hope you take that as the supreme compliment that it's meant
to do.
Be.
No, okay. I absolutely do take that as a compliment. And I will say this, I'm very flattered that you asked me to do this podcast because eventually I would have found out that you were doing a podcast and my feelings would have been hurt that you didn't ask. So birds, one stone. Yeah.
Thank God that you're not up on the latest podcast because this thing's been going on for a while.
How long? 3 years.
Something like that. Yeah.
Oh, geez. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Jesus Christ. And, honestly, you've been on the list from the initial moment that I had this podcast of like, here's who I want. And then I just never reached out because I was... I said this to you, and we talked about it a little bit a minute ago. I framed it as, look, say no, because I hate it when people ask me like, you know, like, hey, do you have an hour and a half to spend on making content for me? And, you know, and it's always kind of like, oh, I don't know. Do I like you? Yeah, I guess I like you enough.
It's a hard ask. It's a hard ask. And a lot of people have podcasts, and I have been asked to do podcasts by strangers.
Yeah.
And basically now what I say is I do my friends' podcasts.
Yeah.
That's what I do. Unless it's something fascinating.
Right. Or if it's like, you know, I don't know, if Dr. Fauci wanted me on his podcast, I suppose I'd say yes. I don't know what I talk about.
You would. You would say yes. Too political for me. Don't care for it.
Yeah, but I mean, I could steer him into just comedy, you know.
That's true. If anyone can do it, it's you.
Yeah. Just, you know, disease comedy, that
kind
of thing.
What do you have to lose by asking him to do your podcast? You have nothing to lose by asking him. And you know
nothing.
What?
That's true.
Maybe he'd like to be a little comedic right now.
No, I could. All right. I'm going to write that down.
You can ask anyone.
Dr. Fauci. Yeah, but it would really probably hurt me with my right wing fans.
But aren't you? Wouldn't they want to hear from him too? Don't people want to hear from him? Whether they agree with him or not?
Rage listen. Yeah, they could rage listen. I suppose so.
That's where we.
Well, how are you? What are you doing with yourself?
I'm doing animation voices and narration and.
But you have like I saw an LGBTQ horror movie coming out. What's that about?
It's actually a very, very good movie. I'm very proud of it. I think it's beautiful and smart and funny and horrifying. It's a psychological horror thriller about a young gay man going through basically a mental breakdown that results in he's feeling pain. and sort of causing himself pain, and he can't get to the bottom of what it is, what's causing it. And mm-hmm. you sort of find out it's childhood trauma and his mother's mentally ill, and it's about sort of this discovery of mental illness and going through the medical system and seeing how people respond to it and what it does to your relationships. And I'm only in it for one scene.
Okay.
And it was right in the middle of the pandemic.
And what's it called?
It's called Hypochondriac.
Hypochondriac.
Yeah. All and right. It stars Zach Villa. It's now I can't remember everybody else in it.
Well, you shouldn't Madeline. Have to. IMDb it, people. Look it up.
IMDb it. It's great. I don't know when it's coming out. It's coming out okay. this summer. I know XYZ bought it at South by Southwest or mm-hmm. Sundance or something.
Well, that's cool.
What about you? What about you? You're doing the podcast. You're doing...
I'm doing the podcast. I am waiting for the phone to ring. I'm have fingers crossed there's still an Andy Richter market out there. But
there
it
is.
It,
what do you mean?
No, I mean just... No, I mean, it's a weird, very entitled, very lucky situation to have been on a show like The Conan Show for 11 years and to sort of... lose that sort of armor plating that working freelance gives you, you know, that sort of when your parents say, well, after this job, what's next? And you go, I don't know. And then they go, oh my God, how do you live like that? And you go, I don't know. I just do. and I lost that because I got used to a steady paycheck and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and as everyone will say, it's not a great time to be a 55-year-old white man out trying to get work. And that's fine with me. I understand what's behind that. And I do not want to come off as that I'm grousing about that at all, because we white guys have had it real good and we don't have a lot of room for bitching. So, but I'm just waiting. I'm actually shooting something. Chelsea Peretti is, written and directed and starring in, which is insane that she's doing that, a movie that I have a part in that's called First Time Female Director. And it'll be out in 6 years, probably. you know, after everyone in the cast's facial surgery has rendered them unrecognizable. So I'm doing that, and that's really fun. And I'm trying to develop stuff, and you know, but mostly just... hanging out with my dog and my kids. And I got a real wonderful girlfriend now, and we spend lots of time together, and that's it. And how's your husband? How's your hubby?
My husband's the best. My husband is my engineer.
Uh-huh.
So he's a composer, and he's been scoring indie films and documentaries. And we built a recording studio there was like this 5 month, I don't want the neighbors to hear, but they know. There was like a 5 month loophole in where we live in Los Angeles that allowed you to turn your garage into anything you want without specific permits.
Oh,
so
wow.
We turned our garage into a recording studio. So it's soundproofed. It's a floating, it's like a room within a room.
How did you know that? Like you just knew like there was some lapsing in
yeah,
laws
we heard,
or something?
Yeah, I heard about it, and we had talked about building a studio. And this was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And so we did it. Then when the pandemic hit, I immediately thought, oh, okay, this is going to be Spanish flu. This is going to be 2 years.
Yeah.
And this, you know, 1917, 1918, that was before people were flying all over the world with a fair amount of ease. So I thought this is going to be 2 years. We're going to be locked in. So we ordered a vocal booth, because the room didn't have that before, and put in a vocal booth. And the entire time, with the exception of one day on Hypochondriac and 1 week playing Hilary Duff's mother on How I Met Your Father, I did one episode. All of my work has been voiceover, narration, animation voices, crime, documentary series narration, in that studio.
Wow.
With my husband recording and running the, you know, the computer and the board and everything while I'm in the booth. And so it's been, we were really fortunate that we had the equipment to to stay safe and continue working.
Right.
And so I've just been hustling for, you know, I had done animation before the pandemic, but it's been my sole focus.
It's really fun work too, isn't it?
I love it.
It's great. Yeah. And also too, it's not, you didn't have any, I imagine that there's no decrease in quality. You know, like you're sending up, because I mean, I, for instance, I watched the behind the scenes of Disney Rides show, because I'm that kind of nerd. And I was like, wait a minute, that's Padgett.
Yeah.
Doing the voiceover for that.
That was actually the first job that we got, and we didn't have the vocal booth yet. So we built a vocal booth out of furniture pads, you know, what they wrap up.
Sure.
And these things called gobos that are standing, padded, insulated, like a folding, you know, it looks like, I'm trying to describe for people
like
at home.
Like egg crate, like the foam egg crate kind of stuff.
No. It's like standing hard structure on a hinge. So it folds like, it folds up. It's thick. It's like, you know, 4 inches thick each wall with a hinge on it. So we had three of those and then draped fabric over it. And
so you could get
and
in.
All the egg carton stuff on the inside and on the floor. And so that's how we recorded behind the attraction. Then our vocal booth showed up. And so we haven't stopped. And I love it. It's hard to, it's so much fun. Listen, it doesn't pay what a TV show pays, you know, like a network show, but it's being able to do it from home and feel like, you know, we're running a business. We should buy a cappuccino machine for our business lunch is really fun. So he and we're both kind of, we're slightly hermits anyway. So this has been, we've been extremely fortunate.
Yeah.
To enjoy each other's company. My hobby is cooking. So that wasn't a big leap when suddenly, you know, you couldn't go to restaurants or so we've weathered this, knock wood, that it's ending soon fairly well.
Yeah. Well, now this podcast, I don't know if you're the concept of this podcast.
Yes, I looked it up.
OK, so we should get into the where do you come from part. Which yes. I know a little bit,
okay.
But you're from Massachusetts.
That is correct.
And your parents were both school administrators at sort of like boarding schools, right?
I grew up on the campus of a school in Concord, Massachusetts called Middlesex, which was a private boarding school. It was all boys until 1976 or 77, and then it went co-ed. Mm-hmm. So I and my younger brother, Ivan, we grew up in a dormitory, and our parents were dorm parents. My dad was an English teacher, and he coached soccer and crew, you know, And my mother was the ceramics teacher. And later on, my dad became college placement and admissions and, you know, did different jobs within Middlesex. It's an unusual way to grow up. It's the boarding school from, there's some Brendan Fraser movie that shot at that boarding school. It's beautiful. It's safe. It's protected. So, you know, all of the faculty kids who were living in dorms, we were just free to roam. We had a pond. We had an ice rink. There was a library. And, you know, we just had this safe environment.
Idyllic, I imagine, too.
Truly,
you know, because like a John Irving summer, novel or something. Yeah.
I mean, less bleak than the, you know, happiest John Irving novel. Like it really was. And we thought everyone lived that way. We thought everyone's parents didn't work for 3 months during the summer. It didn't occur to me. I think I was 15 when I realized, wait a minute, most people work all year.
Yeah.
All year. How can I be that old?
Well, and it's also just like the fact to live in a dorm is kind of, you know, that's a very, I had never heard of like kids living in a dorm, because then in the 3 months in the summer that your parents didn't work, but you still were on campus and.
Sometimes. Yeah. But they did when they were, my mom and dad, also they got married very young. My mom was 19 and my dad was 23 when they got married.
Wow.
She was 21 when I was born.
Wow.
So my dad was 25. And my brother came 2.5 years later. They bought a little house in rural Maine next to where my dad's mother, my grandmother, Joan, lived in Maine. So we had this, it's kind of like a barn, of a barn. It was built in 1780 something. It was, you know, this, and it's cold in Maine, but we would only be there in the summer.
Yeah.
So we had this, you know, beautiful, oh, will we go to Maine for the summer? I mean, it was an extremely privileged upbringing.
You went to Maine to get a taste of real life.
Yeah.
And what it's really like.
Yeah.
When
Dad's
it's kind
gonna
of,
go shoot the porcupines tonight.
Kind of chilly at night. That's,
oh, stop
you know.
It. No, there are ticks, Andy. Ticks.
Well, now, was it weird? Because, I mean, I imagine the students at Middlesex are pretty well-to-do. Was it weird being around a bunch of rich kids and being known as, like, a teacher's kid within this world of rich kids?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was born in 1969. So in the 70s, in the middle 70s, when it became a co-ed boarding school, there was a lot of pot smoking. At one point, some rich kid dosed all of the pets with LSD.
The pets?
The pets, all of the faculty pets. And some of them died. One time, a kid lit a... My brother and I were bugging a couple of kids in another dorm who were, you know, teenagers. They were just playing ping pong. And I'm sure my brother and I were irritating. And, you know, no one wants random kids running around. And a kid lit a ping pong ball on fire and hit it at me. So there were some, it was, you know, it was that I remember.
Who knew that you could even do that?
I didn't know you could. I can't believe that kid did it. Did he douse it in like lighter fluid? I mean, now that I'm saying it, I'm trying to figure out how that even happened.
Maybe they do burn.
I think I smoked pot for the first time probably when I was 6 or 7. I was up in the dormitory.
What?
In the girls' dormitory.
Wow.
And the babysitter said, you know, suck on this, you know, and it was just a joint. And then I remember she was drying her hair with a blow dryer, and I just watched her drying her hair with a blow dryer, and, you know, it was just so bizarre. And I took the blow dryer from her, and it sucked my hair into the thing in the back. So I don't really like pot. Maybe that was a weird, but you know, listen, basically harmless, nothing really. Our dog Torque didn't die from the LSD dosing.
Became a huge fish fan.
He did. He was really into Blue Strip.
Well, as you get, I mean, I imagine you and your brother went to school there then, yeah?
Part of my parents' pay was that their children, if their test scores were good enough, could go to Middlesex for free.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in and it just did not belong there. Mm. And it was not a good fit. And I was, you know, at that point, listen, I grew to be a beautiful young lady.
You certainly did.
Thank you. But when I was a kid, not great. Kind of looked like a little vulture. Braces. I had a like a men's military haircut that I thought worked on my head shape. But I was not popular. I wasn't cool. I wasn't wealthy. I was a fac brat. You know, the faculty kid is a fac brat. So it was, it was diminished. It was tough. High school was tough. And I was failing my classes and I was asked to leave, which broke my parents' heart. But I think they then realized, oh, this also would not be a good fit for our son. So I went back to, I had been in all, my parents' priority for my brother and I was education. So they put all of their money and were helped by my grandparents to put my brother and I into same-sex schools. The private schools in Concord that were not where my parents taught were a boys' school and a girls' school. So I had gone to girls' school until I was 14 or 15 and started at this, you know, this wealthy New York City, you know, co-ed school where suddenly I was just, I was just a loser. Yeah. And so it was not a good experience for me. So when I was asked to leave, I begged my parents to send me to the girls' school that my mom went to in Westchester, New York. And so I did. They were kind enough to pay for that. And I, my senior and junior years, I was at a school in Dobbs Ferry, New York.
And it was better.
All girls. Yeah. There. I mean, there are so few all girls schools, and who knows if that would even work now? But it worked for me. Mm-hmm. It was a safe environment, and it felt, you know. Girls weren't competing against each other for the attention of boys. There weren't sort of clique hierarchies. It was, I found that everyone had a valuable place in that society. And whether you were, you know, a beautiful rich girl or a nerd or a jock or a mathlete, in a single sex environment, everybody was, you still had your place.
Right.
So it was a weird, there's a big difference in schooling if you're around, you know, boys.
Yeah, I've always, because my ex-wife went to girls' Catholic school, and I've known women that went to, you know, non-co-ed schools. Mm-hmm. And it does seem, I mean, from just my life experience, like there is a real benefit to that. And that the introduction of boys into girls' scholastic lives is quite often destructive and quite often disruptive. Whereas I do think like boys going to school with boys, I feel like that's fine because then they can just be boys. They can just be, you know, boys to themselves. Like, I don't think that boys are in any way endangered by women. And I do realize that this is the same rationale that keeps women in other parts of the country or in other parts of the world wearing scarves and being isolated into their own restaurants and their own places of worship. I understand that that's the same rationale, but it's like, I do feel like, yeah, I bet as a girl, it is kind of nice to go to a school where there aren't those stupid fucking boys around, you know?
I mean, I think everything has an advantage and a disadvantage.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was sort of really properly socialized. I had a lot to learn when I graduated high school about men and women because I hadn't really, you know, grown up having to navigate how teenage competition, sexuality, misogyny, sexism, homophobia. Like there were girls at the school. There were teachers at the school that were gay, and nobody, it didn't matter. You know, it felt like, well, girls don't care. It becomes something else outside in the real world. So I think there were disadvantages to that as well. But I also think there is a difference in if a country requires men and women to be separate. These are also countries that do not allow for the LGBTQ lifestyle.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a different thing, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I also
it's just one of those things that I'm left a little uncomfortable with, but it's kind of like, well, yeah, but, you know, at a certain point, there's like real life experience sometimes trumps what may seem like an ideal, you know?
Yeah. But even my saying to you, it was a girls' school, because we've learned so much, specifically in the last 5-10 years, that now sounds so antiquated to
mm-hmm.
me. And
mm-hmm.
and there's a reason why. It's from another generation. It's just from another generation.
Yeah.
Because those girls' schools were also teaching etiquette and dancing and,
right.
you know, how to marry a boy from the boys' school. I mean,
right.
you know, so it's...
yeah, and if you're going to have a career, it'll be, you know, as a spinster teaching your classmates' children or something like that. You're not going to be a fucking engineer, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
There was no STEM. There was
yeah.
No, I learned how to fence, and I learned French.
That just in case, you know, some Quebecois street gangs come down here and start hassling people.
I practice neither these days.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, what did you want when you got out of school, as you were getting towards the end of your schooling and it was time to go to college? What were you looking for?
Because my parents were teachers, I knew I had to go to college, and I wanted to go to an art college. I had always excelled in art and English, but I didn't see the value of a degree in English or literature or art history. I just didn't understand what you did with your life at that point. Although, you know, what do you do with a degree from Parsons School of Design? I don't know what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I got in, but I really just wanted to get to New York so I could act.
Really? Now, were you acting in high school?
The whole time. Yeah, a lot of acting.
Yeah.
But it was inconceivable that anybody would. I didn't know Juilliard existed. I would never have gotten into Juilliard, but I didn't know that acting colleges, also that just would not be accepted. That was not acceptable.
Yeah, same. And I mean, I'm from a little town in Illinois, but it's the same thing. It's just like, no, you don't, nobody does that.
No one does that. No one does that for a living. So So I went to Parsons for not even 1 year. I went to Parsons School of Design. I was living in the George Washington Welfare Hotel on 23rd and Lex.
Wow.
In an 8x8 room, but I had my own bathroom. So that was very luxurious.
That's nice. Yeah.
8 feet by 8 feet, not like an 8-room apartment.
I understand. I understand.
I know, but if you didn't
know. It wasn't 8 bedrooms and 8 bathrooms.
I mean, well, it sounds like, well, she went to boarding school and learned how to fence. This bitch probably had an 8-bedroom apartment in Manhattan when she fucking felt like it. No. So I went to Parsons just the foundation year and auditioned. I was, doing NYU thesis films, and I was acting in Friends Little Things. And I ended up doing auditioning for Hurley Burley, the David Rabe play at Circle in the Square.
Wow.
Theater group. Even though I didn't go to NYU, I wasn't part of
it. As a freshman in college.
I wasn't even there. I was at Parsons.
That's what I mean. But you were, that's how young you were that you got that audition.
Yeah. Yeah. I was 18. Yeah. And so I got the part of Darlene and went and apologized to all of my teachers at Parsons and said, this isn't you. It's me. I should never have been here in the first place. You're a great teacher. Because I knew how heartbroken my parents were year after year when they would have students that didn't try or didn't care or, they taught me a profound respect and appreciation, and I think understanding of teachers who care, really, really care. And it hurts them when they can't excite or teach or inspire kids. So I apologized to all my teachers and dropped out. And my parents said, well, that's it. You're out. You're out. You're out of the family, and we're not going to pay your rent, and we're not going to help you out. And I was like, no problem. And so I was waitressing, and I mean, my rent was $495 a month because it was that little room.
Yeah.
With people, you know, a lot of sort of mentally ill people and people on SSI living on my floor. It wasn't a coveted apartment space. Mm-hmm. So I could cover the bills, waitressing and then later bartending. But then I was too chicken to even, I didn't even try to go to acting school or anything. I started singing in a band. I put a band together, ended up, you know, living with my drummer and, great guy, you know, cool guy. We were together mm-hmm. for a long time, and we had a band called Mechanical Bride, and then I did a dance band, like some club. We had a club hit covering that song Aquarius by the Fifth Dimension.
Wow.
And I wasn't trying to pursue acting. I thought I would be I thought our band would be so big. I'd be Paget, the singer, like Cher or Sting. Mm-hmm. I would just mm-hmm. be offered acting roles in Oscar winning films. And
right.
Yeah. I had a real good plan.
Well, it must have felt good to have your parents say, all right, rouse. And then you were like, all right, fine. And you did it. And did they come around to respecting the fact that you did that?
They did. They did. And I always knew if something went wrong, if I needed medical help, if something really went wrong, that they would be there to help me. I wasn't abandoned. I wasn't estranged. I wasn't, you know, they just said, if this is the choice you're going to make, you're going to have to support it. And mm-hmm. I now feel like, well, every parent should say that to every 18 or 19 year old. I mean, the world has changed, and I think people just can't afford housing now. So that actually wouldn't work. But for my age and my generation, I completely respect that they said, we don't understand what you think you're going to do, and we're going to make you prove that you can do it. And they did. And I did. And so it, you know, worked out great.
Yeah. And so you did. I mean, you say, you know, that you thought, oh, you would be a, you know, a mono name.
That was the hope.
But that's not like a real plan. Did you have a plan, or did you just kind of, you know, follow one thing after the other and kind of just instinctively go from one opportunity to the other just as they presented themselves?
No, I did not have a plan. I didn't have a plan. And I think, honestly, the plan was, I had been told by all of my teachers and all of my drama teachers and everyone at school, you know, from second grade on, oh, you should act. You're a great actress. Oh, you're funny, but you can be serious and you're great. And I was so scared to really try. And I feel like I spent years of my life walking around with, I thought this was like my get out of jail free card. Like, but I can act. And as soon as I put my mind to it, I'm going to be a huge success. And I just was too scared to try.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. I mean, I didn't even end up, I was going to acting school in San Francisco, and this is from 93 to 96,
mm-hmm.
And bartending. And I got an agent, and he sent me, he hung out at my bar in Potrero mm-hmm. Hill in San Francisco, and he sent me on auditions. They were auditions for anchor people, correspondents, talk show hosts, because that's what he specialized in. I didn't know there was a different kind of agent.
So there's lots of that going on in San Francisco in particular,
No, just there are agents for, do you want to host? Do you want to, you know, be a pitch person on QVC or a host for a kids show or, you know, they're anchor people and it's all hosting. So I just through good luck ended up with a talk show. Because in 1994, Ricky Lake was this huge talk show for Fox.
Mm-hmm.
So then suddenly every production company wanted anyone in their 20s to host a talk show.
Yeah.
And I was signed by
women,
Westinghouse.
Was it just women?
No.
Oh, women and men.
No,
oh, okay.
No, the guy, Mark Wahlberg, the other Wahlberg,
who hosts
Temptation Island.
Yeah.
No, there were other guys too. It was mostly women. It was Tempest Bledsoe, Gabrielle Carteris. Me, there are so many people had talk shows. It was just a huge, huge fad, like a trend. Yeah. So I did the pageant show in San Francisco. I hosted a talk show for 65 episodes and we aired at 1:30 in the morning. And through that, I got an agent in Los Angeles and moved to Los Angeles in 1996.
Wow.
And told that agent, I want to pursue acting, not hosting. And he started sending me on acting auditions.
Well, that's good. Because usually you tell them what, they only set you up with what, set you up with what works.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to act.
How am I going to make my 10%?
Right.
That's what they're thinking.
Yes, exactly. And it's kind of like, why don't you just do more of the thing that somebody already paid you for?
Which I understand now because that's what I want to do now.
Was the talk show just kind of your standard sort of, cheating boyfriends kind of? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And was it fun or was it sort of,
I loved it. I loved it. It was, had a microphone in the audience, it was a live audience, 150 people maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A panel, chairs, up to 14 guests. We had a drag queen fashion show, like Ms. Paget. We had I Love Him, Why Do My Parents Hate Him? We had, this guy, Dave Green and his 15 polygamists, the polygamy family from Utah,
oh, wow.
and his wives. And, we did all of that stuff, that everybody was doing. And then it got really Jerry Springer. Suddenly things were getting violent. And Westinghouse hired these producers and said, we need fights. We need fights if we're going to take this national. And I would just never let anyone fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was what bartending was really good for. You can see when someone, and they produced it so that these people would end up physically fighting each other, and I could see it coming, and I would just run up to the stage and put my leg on the chair arm between the two people about to fight, and they're not going to hit me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, and I learned that from bartending, all the years that I was bartending, that it's easier for me to stop a fight between anyone, two guys, two girls, a guy and a girl. It's easier for the bartender because no one wants to hit the bartender. Like mm-hmm. now you get no booze.
Right.
So it's like, and most people don't want to fight.
Yeah.
Most people are waiting for an excuse to not have to get into a physical fight. So,
yeah.
So the pageant show was only 1 year, 65 episodes. And then I moved to LA.
But you then probably had somewhat of a little nest egg to move down to LA and get started. And, and was that weird? Did you have people in LA or were you kind of,
No.
getting off the bus with your cardboard suitcase and your sundress?
I had just gotten my driver's license.
Wow.
I was 26.
Yeah.
96. No, I was 27.
Uh-huh.
I was moved here in 96. So I was 27 years old. I'd just gotten my driver's license. I think I had saved $5,000.
Wow.
And I got an apartment on Poinsettia Place in Hollywood. And there was some criminal element.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an agent before I got here, and that agent was great and probably did illegal things like lied to networks, sent me on auditions, and then would say, no, she's not going to do that TV show. She has a development deal with ABC, which was a lie. And then NBC was like, wait, she's not going to do this. She just auditioned for a show and you won't let her test. Nope. She's got an overall deal at ABC. So NBC's like, well, we'll give her an overall deal then. What do you? And then he's like, okay. And then calls Fox and says, hey, there's this new kid in town, the feeding frenzy, all these development deals. You might be interested. And he just fabricated.
Awesome. Fantastic.
He's brilliant.
You should have paid him 11%.
I should have.
Yeah.
He's in my will. I'm working on my will.
Oh, really?
Right now.
Oh, that's
I'm sending
good.
Him a
that's
little,
good.
A little party money, like, hey, go on a nice vacation with your kids. Thanks. Thanks for the leg up.
Yeah. Now, is this a time, because I know from when I worked with you, on Andy Richter Controls the Universe. Look it up, folks. Way before its time.
Way before its time.
Which people tell me that. And I'm always like, well, that doesn't, that's not really comforting. Like, you were, that was way before its time. It's kind of like, I mean, it's nice and I understand it, but it's sort of like, is it really? I don't know. I mean, you know, it just feels like, it just felt like wrong, you know, or it didn't work. And I mean, and there's all these things that go into it, like whether or not it gets supported or whether or not it gets understood or whatever. And I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't some sort of complicated algorithm. It was just a show with cutaways, you know, but... you know, whatever.
When people say to you ahead of its time, you feel like you're hearing it just was the wrong time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only you had waited 5 years to do that show.
Happen?
I know. It's like that doesn't happen. And I'm not going to sit around waiting 5 years like, oh, man, I met this guy that's got this idea for a show and I'm going to help him put it together. But let's just wait 5 years, you know.
It's wait till the time is right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wait till the rest of the world catches up with us. Us visionaries.
Can people see it? Is it on like a Fox?
I think so. I think it's on YouTube or somewhere. I mean, it was on DVD, but people ask me that, and I don't know because I hate looking at myself. So I hopefully maybe like I'll become gravely ill and my children will seek it out and then we'll find out. No, but anyway, back to the topic. I knew you a little bit because you were dating somebody that I knew through the Chicago diaspora, Chicago comedy diaspora. So we had met.
Yes, I had met you before. We knew each other socially.
Yes, exactly. But then I got connected with Victor Fresco, who created Andy Richter Controls the Universe. Mm-hmm. He had worked with you on a previous show. Mm-hmm. That did like 6 episodes or something like that?
Yes. We had done Trouble with Normal.
Yeah. And you played a shrink with a bunch of goofballs. A bunch
A bunch of people with anxiety issues.
So, but he wrote this part for you, the part of Jessica, my boss and friend, for you.
That's what I've heard.
But the thing that we heard from the network was... and this is just still among all the dumb shit I've ever heard. She's been involved in a lot of pilots that didn't go.
True. That was true.
So we're not going to cast her. Uh-huh. She's good. Oh, undeniably. Yeah, she's great. The part was written for her. Oh, well, I can see why. She's really great. And just because she's been on other shows that have 100 other reasons to fail... you're going to punish her by not letting her do our show? Yep, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
So we cast another woman in that role who was a lovely, talented actress, but just not right and as good. And then when it came to the end of that, and I apologize to her if she's listening, I'm not going to see her. But, you know, but the part was meant for you. And they let us hire you, you know, in that. Like, it was like that they were like, you know, like, all right, we'll let you move away from that open flame so as not to burn yourself. Like they were doing a big favor. It's like, no, thank you for letting us do this thing that will be good for everyone involved.
That was tough because I auditioned three times.
Yeah, and that thing with the pilots, tell me about like how you can be successful enough to get in a bunch of pilots, but then have that be your fault.
Oh, I mean, look, the two people I knew of who were called show killers for a while were myself and John Cryer.
Wow.
And we both overcame the stink of failure that surrounded us like a cloud. We both did a lot of pilots. It wasn't just pilots. We were called pilot killers, but we did pilots and then we would do shows that the pilot was picked up, but we were canceled by the third or sixth episode. So executives start to think, what if it's just bad mojo. What if it's easier to blame? Let's blame a couple of actors as show killers. Call them show killers. Then we don't have to worry about anyone thinking we made a poor choice with writers or producers or directors or sets or time slots or advertising or, you know, it's.
Yeah. Or our own stupid fucking ideas that we impose on people. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And listen, there are great executives and there are bad executives. Yeah.
There's a lot more of one than the other, though.
I don't know what they are supposed to do.
Oh, I mean, I will give them that. If I had to run a network, it would tank. Like if I program things, it would all just be, well, first of all, it would just be my friends. but you know, like I wouldn't pick, name a big hit sitcom right now. If you brought that to me and said, I don't mean really name them, just you out there listening to this, name one. If you brought that to me, I would go, ick, no, ugh, terrible, you know, hacky bullshit, get out of here. Whereas those are like, love it, can't get enough. Two spoons, yum, yum, yum. So I would be terrible at it, but it still baffles me how there's this whole business of people that hire talented people, good-looking people, you know, people that you enjoy watching, and then they know better than all of those people at what, you know, at them doing what they do, what they were hired to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
we're on the other side too.
It's true.
We are, you know, we're enemies.
Yes.
We're essentially enemies.
Yes. And also to say, like, to call you a pilot killer is part of a
show killer.
Show killer.
That's what, yeah.
John Cryer show killers is part of a system that says, when you say, when someone, a young executive finds someone like you or a John Cryer and comes in and says, hey, I found this person, this thing, this idea, this script. And it, to me, it seems really good. Everybody above them says, who else has spent money on them? And because they have to, like, you can't just go, I mean, it's the same reason everything's superheroes now. Because if you say, oh man, I have this great noirish script that's just full of twists and turns and really rock solid. Oh yeah, it was ever a comic book? No, it's just a script. Well, fuck you. It's the same thing with people. It's like, have they made a ton of money for somebody else? And because you had been in these things that were, you know, I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. In these things that, you know, for some reason or another, the thousand reason that things go bad, but it's your fault because you were there, because you happened to be there. And it's so fucking crazy. It's so dumb. You know, it's like,
I love watching you go crazy. I love it so much.
It's just, I think I just, and then it like I get metaphor mad where I'm like, you know, like just cause a sandwich shop went bad doesn't mean the ham's terrible. Sell the ham somewhere else. What the fuck? You know, it's like maybe the sandwich shop was poorly run. The guy had a gambling problem. That makes the ham bad? Anyhow, well, anyway, it worked out because, I mean, to a sort of a, you know, a half-assed way in that we got a couple of really wonderful, that was truly one of the top jobs ever, like for me, was just.
Oh, our show? Yes.
Yeah, just the fun of it and just the, you know, just how nice it was and how fun it was and how
it was.
We did get two mid-seasons out of it. And that was just because Gail Berman, who was running the network at the time, begged and pleaded for them to give us another network. But beyond her, it was just like a group of these kind of beef-eating men who were like, where's the titties? You know, where's the cars that blow up? And I remember there was some sort of, There was some sort of show on that, like, I want to say, like, it was a show created by Mick G or somebody like that, that was just all car explosions.
Wait, that sounds so familiar. And I think titties. There was.
It was, no, yeah, I'm not, no, I seriously, think there was. At that exact same time. And yeah. That was the show that they were like, this is going to be it.
They were putting all their money behind, all their advertising, yeah, everything.
Yeah, I think Peter Scolari was in it. I don't remember what it was called.
Peter Scolari was
yeah.
in it?
Yeah. Somebody could look it up. You know, whatever that was, you know, 2001, 2002.
That did happen.
Yeah,
did happen.
It was just dumb show with, like, lots of cars, mm-hmm. lots of girls in bikinis, and lots of explosions. And that's from my shorthand for it was exploding titty. That, like, that's what they really were looking for, was exploding titty.
And listen, there is a place in the world for exploding titties.
And there is quality exploding titty. You know, like, there's really good exploding
titties.
Sometimes
it's done very well.
Yeah, but it's just like, not everything has to be that, and we certainly did not have that.
But wasn't Victor Fresco, our EP, our boss, wasn't he nominated for an Emmy after our show was canceled? Like,
we got a nomination for a writing Emmy. You know, but I mean, but they've done that. The Ben Stiller show, they gave them the writing Emmy after they were canceled.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah. So it's been done before. So, mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean, we both, you know, we both
we
are
paid
trapped.
Our doozies.
We both are trapped in our houses speaking into microphones now. So things worked
so
out.
So it all evens out.
we worked out for both of us.
I just spoke on a Zoom with John Cryer a few nights ago.
Oh, did you? Yeah, yeah.
You're doing fun.
I used to see him in the Warner Brothers gym, and it was always so lovely to see him.
He's great.
Yeah,
he's
great. A wonderful guy. Mm-hmm. So then after that, though, your career took a turn towards the dark. you descended into criminality and the psychology surrounding it.
And I'm so happy I did.
Was that now, and I'm talking, of course, about Criminal Minds,
yes.
which it was a rocky road. On that show,
true. I think
undeniably, you know, like yes. You were on the ins, then you were on the outs, then you were uh-huh. back on the ins.
Yes.
And was that, how did you feel going from doing comedy and being so gifted in comedy to then doing these kind of procedural sort of, you know, super hyper drama kind of show?
I loved it.
Oh, you
I
did?
Was ecstatic. Yeah. Yeah. I joined Criminal Minds in the ninth episode of the second season. So that was 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I had met everybody when they were shooting the pilot for Criminal Minds in Vancouver because I was shooting a made-for-TV movie. So I'd hung out with the cast. Mm. A year and a half goes by. I thought, actors do movies. I should do movies. I'm not going to do any more TV. I'm going to do movies. And so I did three movies back to back, and they all needed reshoots, and they were all kind of messy. And so I was flying back and forth, Austin, Texas, fly to LA, drive to Lancaster, go shoot this movie in New Orleans. And I was in New Orleans in 2005, and my agent called and said, would you be interested in meeting on this show called Criminal Minds? And it was on the TV. Like, I don't know how it was already in a repeat, but the pilot episode was playing. It might have been on A&E already or something. And I said, yes, of course, I would love to meet with them because I realized movies are, this is not for me.
Yeah.
It's just flying around, living in a hotel and trying to do your laundry. And
yeah.
There still was a lot of misogyny on set. So it's, you know, how do you avoid these people on mm-hmm. location? Like, it just wasn't for me. And
there's no continuity. It's not even like you can deal with the misogyny and then continue, you know, like make your workplace better because everybody's going to be gone.
It's it's all, and people are having affairs on location, you know, and I don't want to see it. I don't want to be around it. I don't want to know. I just want to go to a job where I drive to work. I go in every day. I know everybody. Hey, Hal, you know, hey, Georgie, you know, and you do your job and you're all working towards something. So I realized that I don't need, you know, if a great movie comes along and I can do, you know, pop that out in a couple of, you know, once a year, twice, not even twice a year. I very rarely do them. I prefer TV. Mm-hmm. So I met with the producers and writers and the creator, or the creator of Criminal Minds was fired for, I think he said something on Facebook that he was going to murder one of his writers. So the guy who created it just gets money forever and never ran the show.
Note to you aspiring writers out there, get fired after the first episode. You're creating something.
You created it. Oh, money forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I met with the people at Criminal Minds and I was one of those people that read everything about serial killers. I watched every documentary and interview series and true crime, and I loved it. I ate it up. That's your two spoons, eat it up. Mm-hmm. I was that gal.
Yeah.
And so when I met with, and also all I did on location going everywhere was I was watching Law and Order, and I appreciated it so much. I was like, this makes me feel like I'm home. I have this I can count on every night, no matter what city I'm in. I can watch this show and I know gung gung. I've got my friends and I'm going to enjoy myself. And there was something comforting about it. And so when I met with the people at Criminal Minds, they started saying, oh, you know, where this is typical of a case, it would be a case like this. And, you know, this is what's happening with our killer. This is the show we're working on this week. And I said, oh, I that's based on the Toy Box Killer. And they said, what? I said, it's based on, and I remembered his name then. I don't now. And I said, oh, this guy and his common law wife was in Kansas in 1987. And they were a little appalled. But they said, how do you know that? About that case. And I was like, oh, I read everything. Da, 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 da. And I think that was it. I think that's when they thought,
she's on to us. We better shut her up. She's on to us that we're ripping off real crimes and we need to get her in here to just shut her up. Shove a paycheck in her mouth.
They said, do you have any questions for us? And I said, and I really hope I don't get in trouble for this. My only question is, how crazy is Mandy Patinkin? Because he was the lead on that show at the time. And, you know, everyone heard stories about him. And they said, oh, no. You'll love him. He's not a crazy. It's not that kind of crazy. He just sometimes doesn't want to do what we wrote. And, you know, he can be testy about things that he doesn't agree with. But he's incredible and he's a great actor and you'll love him. You guys will sing show tunes together and you'll have a great time. And they were 100% right.
Okay.
I loved working with Mandy. I would work with Mandy again.
Yeah.
Drop of a hat. I think he's fabulous. But he's a, you know, he's a dramatic, interesting character. And
yeah.
I can see how it can lead to difficulties.
A capital A actor, that's for sure.
But he's absolutely worth it. So that was, yeah.
I say good for you for asking that, because it, and usually that kind of question, where you corner, you're not just like, yes, whatever it takes. Yes, whatever it takes.
Yeah, no.
They honestly don't really want that. If you say.
Oh, I don't know. You think they respected it?
I think they do.
Oh.
I think that whether they know it or not, I have always felt that whenever I've said no or created a boundary or said, hey, fellas, here's a question about something, which is me taking care of myself.
Yeah.
And making sure that, you know, I'm not getting fucked over here.
Mm-hmm.
I think they always kind of are like, oh, okay, you know. And then, because I think if you, as Margaret Atwood puts it, present rearward, that is a continual invitation, a, like, you know, in perpetuity invitation to get effed in the A.
Wow.
And so I think it was probably in addition to knowing about killers and murderers and in a way that was unsettling to them, obviously.
No, I think you might be right. I think the idea, maybe the distilled idea is, I care enough about me and my quality of life to ask this question, whether it loses me the job or not.
And also, I don't need you. Necessarily,
yeah.
You know, like if this doesn't happen, I'll be okay. I think
and I didn't. And I was lucky. I don't have kids. I don't have ailing parents. My in-laws are healthy. You know, I was allowed to find out, is this something I want to do? Are these the people I want to be around? And number one on the call sheet, it sort of dictates what's going on a set, as evidenced by you on the show we did.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a lovely experience because you're generous and grateful and funny and invested and interested and talented. Like, you were the best number one on the call sheet to make sure a set ran well and with respect and love and joy.
Oh, thank you. It's important to me. It's important to me. I always feel that regardless of where I am in the hierarchy, I went to film school. I like to think of myself as a member of the crew. We're all members of the crew. However, grips don't get their own room and their own toilet. So I'm a very lucky, privileged member of the crew. But also, too, there's lots of people that can do the grips job. There's not as many people that can do the job that I'm doing. So it's like, I understand, you know, there's kind of, you know, it is based on sort of free market ideas in terms of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have always felt disappointed by people who are in a similar situation who don't realize this.
Yeah.
I always feel that morale is my job. Maybe not my first job, but it is certainly a big part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I think that, other than just like I always liked it when I worked for nice bosses that made me, you know, nice bosses, I'll do anything you want. Not anything, but, you know, I'll be happy to be here because you're appreciating me.
Mm-hmm.
Shitty bosses, fuck them. I need some paper towels. I'm stealing these paper towels, and I have always felt that if you're in the top echelon and you ignore your in production, I suppose it could apply to, you know, the auto body shops and stuff. But if you're at the top and you're not concerned about the everyday workday experience of everybody involved, you are being derelict in your duties and you're committing malpractice.
I agree 100%.
And because also, too, it's like I've always found, even if you are the most crass, you know, all people are to me are just machines that I can get productivity out of, nothing works better than kindness. Even if all you give a shit about people that work for you is to just get them to work, be nice to them. You know, like pay them a little better than they think they should be paid or that the rest of the world will pay them. Yeah. And it'll come back to you. I just, you know, it's always been such a simple thing. Well, now, you know, I don't know exactly the ins and outs. And I talked about a little bit the sort of back and forth with Criminal Minds. Do you want to address that at all? Like how that happened and how that I'm more concerned about, like, what it made you feel like what your feelings were from those not on the show, back on the show kind of whirlwind.
It's been documented. There was a backdoor pilot with Forrest Whitaker on Criminal Minds that was going to be a new Criminal Minds show. And we all just kind of think, oh, well, it's the first time Les Moonves has seen, who no longer is the president of CBS. First time he's seen the show and 7 years or something. And 6 years. I don't know that he just said, I want the new women agents, those agents, give me new. I want some new women.
Mm.
And,
I wonder why.
Well, they claimed it was a cost cutting measure, but the women all made a third. Half of what weren't. So it wasn't a cost cutting measure. It was some silly whim, you know, for whatever reason. And the fans got upset and they signed a petition. And my agent did some fancy footwork and I was let go after I had made a deal to finish out at 17 episodes of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And my co-star, AJ Cook, had been let go. She was with a different agent. who she has since left, who didn't do fancy footwork and, you know. So I was fired and I was gone. And I was really mad. We were both really mad. And it was because, you know, we did everything right and we were team players. We were early. We knew our lines. We did the work. We were there every day. We didn't, you know, leave early or show up late, or we weren't rude. We weren't, you know, we didn't have lawsuits against us for sexual harassment. Like, we did everything right.
Yeah.
And we're let go. And our showrunner ultimately quit that year, just saying the network's not even going to let me have my own show. I don't want to fucking be here anymore.
And yeah.
So, but I do. I was so angry for so long and I held on to it. You know how Conan like held on to that rage of, and it just you're poisoning yourself. Like, but it's so hard to get through. And the only person I could like think of that had felt that unfairness, like that, just a sledgehammer to your life and your sense of self, and you did everything you were supposed to do, and it fucks you up.
Yeah.
And the only person I could think of was Conan, because I'd seen, you know, what happened there. And but I still couldn't get past my anger, and I feel like it took a couple years before I could move away from such resentment.
Yeah. Did you and Conan have conversations about it?
No. Oh. I witnessed and I felt like I understood his pain.
Yeah.
And I also started to see, oh, wait, I feel like he was maybe hurting too long. His hurting may be hurting him. You know what I mean? I felt like he was helping me to stop being so angry, because I started to feel empathy. Like, I always understood his anger, but at a certain point I felt like I was watching this person who I think is a lovely person, knowing him through you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I think he might, this might be, he's now in it so long, it's hurting, he's hurting himself. You know what I mean?
I think, because believe me, he and I we didn't have lots of conversations about this. But I think you're right, and I think it's something that I observe too, and I think that he has done over time a good job of cleansing himself of it.
He did, I think he did.
Yeah, stepping away from it, because you're both in a situation too. I mean, I obviously was closer to his, but you're both in a situation where it's really hard to complain to anyone else in the universe about this wrong that's been committed against you, because you have a lot of money. You're talking about a big TV show. You know, I mean, in relative terms, you got a lot of money compared to anybody else. You've been on TV. You still have lots of opportunities laid out before you, but you're still a human being who got kicked in the crotch and who got fucked over and who got treated shitty. And who, again, like you said, did all the right things.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do? Here you go. I did it. And then maybe a little bit more for extra credit. Oh, yeah. By the way, we're fucking you over anyway. That hurts, and that stings, and that makes you angry.
Yeah.
And that makes you, you know, I mean, it can sort of, and then you can kind of, you know, you get reinforcement for that hurt by, you know, a lot, and from a lot of different areas and a lot of people, you know, fans writing petitions and campaigns and things.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel like, well, I'm right to be this hurt. And yeah, you are. But like at a certain point, who are you hurting? Like, who's your grudge hurting?
I started hurting myself. Not physically. I wasn't, doing drugs or cutting or anything.
Right.
But I was emotionally, it just was a toxicity in my system for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally let it go, but just by letting it move through my body, almost like it's like an illness. I had an illness, and I had some shitty symptoms for a couple of years, and then it moved through my system. I didn't go to therapy for it. I wasn't in therapy. I went and got other shows. I was on other shows. I did a year of Community. I did 2 years of Another Period. I did a year of Grandfathered. I did other shows.
Yeah.
And then had gotten past my anger and had agreed to come back and guest star because they had asked me to come back. I just kept saying no. That's how pissed I was.
Yeah.
And when I finally got through it 4 years later, they asked me if I would agree to guest star. They were saying, please come back to the show. And I was like, no. you kicked me in the tit. And so then finally, when I'd gotten past it, they said, well, will you guest star? And I was like, okay, but you got to pay me what you pay me. Like, I'm like, mad. And I'm going to have a, so.
And I'm going to cover up my tits.
Yeah.
No more kicking.
Don't you kick my tit. And so, so I agreed to come back and guest star. And I loved everybody there. I was happy with everybody there. It wasn't, that wasn't the problem. It was like some unknown Darth Vader at CBS that I assume is Les Moonves because it's easier to blame it on that guy.
Right,
in the
right.
same way that I was a show killer for some show. It's easier to blame it on Paget than maybe we picked the wrong director. I don't know. So I was guest starring and Thomas Gibson was let go for something that I wasn't a party to. And he had been the leader of the unit in the, mm-hmm. His character was the leader of the behavioral analysis unit in
the crime eyes.
The crime eyes. Mm-hmm. And so I was there that week and they were like, oh God, what are we going to do? We have to shoot. ABC let him go. And, and so I basically sort of did his, you know, did his part for the episode to make it cohesive. And then the showrunner said, now please come back. Please come back now. Because without him, mm-hmm. we're going to have to get another series regular to do that job. And right now your character is running, you know, Interpol in London.
Yeah.
It turns out I wasn't dead after all, after getting that table leg through the spine. when I was fired. So
what a way to fire somebody. Yeah.
so she said, please come back because if it's not you, we are going to have to hire someone else. And everyone here is really very happy.
Yeah.
And the whole cast was saying the same thing. Please don't let them hire Dick. Why can't it be you? And I'd spent 4 years of people, fans coming up to me in the supermarket and asking for hugs and saying, why are you gone? Why did you leave?
Yeah.
So that week when they presented it to me, I was like, why am I gone? I'm good at this part. Mm-hmm. I love these people. I love this show.
Yeah.
You know, it's not Shakespeare, but it makes people happy and it's fulfilling. And it's like, this is a good gig.
Yeah.
And I do want my job back. And so it was this, you know, it was a lot, but it was all, even the bad parts were good.
And it was it healing? Like, did you feel like the saying yes?
Extremely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And coming back and.
Did your representative say it's going to cost you though? Like, was there any of that like vindictive pricing on you coming back?
Oh no,
back?
That was all me.
Oh.
they were like, oh, this is a great price, settle. And I was like, fuck you. They need me more than I need them. And we did actually get into a fight. I'm no longer with that agent, but I had to send her several thousand dollars worth of gift shoes because I yelled at her on the phone a lot in front of people. It was bad. But I really was strident that I was not going to come back. I didn't need to come back. And I was only going to come back if I was paid not even as much as all of the men, just, you have to give me a raise. You have to pay me more than you were paying me before.
Right.
And this is what the person who left was making. And I know I'm not going to make that, but I need to make more than what I did when you can't.
But also, why not make what he's making? Like,
well,
what,
that was never going to happen. We still weren't there.
I know,
in the
but
world,
in what,
we still weren't there.
I know, but it's outrageous. It's it's continuing outrage, like that everyone goes, well, of course you won't make what Thomas Gibson makes. It's like, why the fuck not?
Well, but I do understand. The fact of the matter was he was there the whole time.
Yeah.
And he did have an enormous value to that show.
Yeah.
And he was great at that character. He was great as Hotch. So I understood. I just didn't put in as much time. So no, I'm not. I get that.
Right, right.
But it was an extremely satisfying. And also, this is one of the last shows that pays royalty. I'm pointing to my TV like you know where my TV is. That pays residuals. So this pandemic, we were still, you know, we're able to save money and pay our mortgage and pay our bills because we have royalties coming in from Criminal Minds.
And that's great.
It was definitely something and I hope that it comes back. We've been talking to Paramount Plus about relaunching it as a streaming series, doing 10 episodes a year. And it sounds like we're getting close, but part of the problem with this show and the firings and everything was it's CBS and ABC and Mark Gordon, and there are a lot of entities. So it's
gets watered
down. It's really hard. It's not easy. It's not ABC for ABC.
Yeah. Well, I've kept you a long time, so we better move on to the what's next in the Padgett Brewster saga. Like, is there something you're not doing that you want to do, or is there
Criminal Minds limited run series for Paramount Plus? I'm not signing that contract today, and I wish I were. I would really like that. I would love for that to happen because we would all love to get back together.
And yeah,
we would love to do that show, but not. I can't do 22 episodes of anything anymore. I could do a multicam, but even multicams have changed.
Yeah.
I would be happy. Okay, in an ideal world, I would do a multicam with a live audience that I loved and thought was really funny and brilliant and exciting. But I don't know if those days will return because I don't know. I mean, with COVID protocols and with it just seems like I don't know that the possibility of that has been suspended. And maybe there's so many cooks in the kitchen now that I don't know if great sitcoms are coming.
Yeah.
So that would be my dream. Criminal Minds, 10 episodes a year. That would be my dream. Otherwise, I really love doing animation and narration. Mm-hmm. And I want to be like Audible's number one voice for crime narration. Like, I want to do docuseries, and I loved that Disney show doing that Disney, the show you saw Behind the Attraction. Making the rides. I love it. And part of it is I'm 53. I don't want to stop drinking wine and eating cheese and lose weight and be in front of the camera. I don't want to dye my hair anymore.
Yeah.
I don't want to put high heels on and try and hit my mark and find my life. I've become, because I put in a lot of work and because I went back to Criminal Minds and it's back into 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day. And I would love to do it again for 10 episodes, but I'm tired. Mm-hmm. And I love doing voices, and I work with so many people who do voices and they just want to act.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, get out of the way.
Yeah.
I've saved money because I knew I was going to age out of this profession, but this voice thing, as long as no one kicks me in the throat, knock wood, hopefully I can keep doing this because I find it extremely satisfying.
Yeah.
I love table reads for animation. I will substitute for anyone in a table read for animation. Mm. I love it.
Yeah.
What about you?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh gosh. I don't know. My life, I mean, work-wise right now, in terms of like what I want to work. I have struggled forever about like, I should be creating more things and then feeling like, nah, it's not really what I do. I work better on assignment. I work better coming into a situation. I was an improviser, not a stand-up. I work better in groups. Most of my best writing has been, I've never touched the keyboard. There's been people sitting in a room and there's one, there's like an intern typing in what we're all saying because we're bouncing things off each other and being inspired by each other. I don't like loneliness. I don't like, the notion of writing my own things sounds great, but then when I sit down to do it, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, what about the people, the friends, the laughs, So work-wise, and I'm also lucky enough to have irons and lots of fires. I have hosted game shows. I'm now pursuing more. I've directed commercials, and I'm pursuing that again now that I have more time with the Conan show. And I would love to parlay that into directing television because I'm absolutely assured of my ability to do it in a very competent way. Because
you would be great.
Thank you. Part of making the Conan show for all those years, and one of the greatest gifts that he gave me, was inviting me into the creative process of that show, into being, and I refer to myself sometimes in a grandiose way, as the comedy consigliere. I was the guy that he would go, does this joke work? And I would say, yes. And then he'd go, okay. Like, and it's, I would want the same thing if I were in his position. Because you can look at something and think, that's really funny. And then you turn to three people you respect and they go, no, it's not. And you go, oh, right. Okay, sorry. Ah. You know. Yeah. Or you can go, all right, there's the inverse. That sucks. And everyone's like, what are you, nuts? That's hilarious. Oh, okay. You know, everybody has a capacity to be wrong. So it's very helpful to have somebody that you have a kind of rock solid belief in that you can go, I'm lost here. What do you think? Yes? Okay, good. Yes. No? All right. No. Then fuck it. We're not going to do it. So he gave me the gift of being able to make television. Mm-hmm. And I did it for thousands and thousands of hours. Mm-hmm. You know, I fixed things on the fly, you know, troubleshooted things. So I would love to be able to direct television. Everybody says that, though. So it's like, I'm not like out, you know, screaming it in the streets or anything. But I love acting.
I think you have the pedigree for it because a lot of the actors on Criminal Minds direct episodes. And they, all of them, did an incredible job. First time directing, they'd never directed it. They directed Criminal Minds. They have a support system and they have an understanding of the show. But yeah, it's the history. It's the observation of how everyone has behaved and succeeded and failed. Mm-hmm. And you have put in all the hours. And I am a victim of the same thing you are, that idea of, and it's why you're so astonished with Chelsea Peretti. She created it. She's directing it. She started this idea, make your own content. Like, everyone's yelling that at us all the time. Like, make your own content. Agents are like, can you make your own content? Like, that I can commission. But I can't. I've tried. I have written pilots. I have written three pilots. I have taken them out. I have met with production companies and managers and studios. And I have worked with a screenwriting couple to create a movie. And it hasn't worked. And if you're creating, also, no one wants new content. No one wants any new content right now. Everything is intellectual property. There is no, here's a new show idea. No one wants it. No one will take a chance on it. Everything has to be, oh, Clifford the Big Red Dog? Oh, Happy Days? Marvel Universe? It has to be something that has made money in the past. So I hear the same, make your own content, but I've tried and it doesn't, I'm not saying it wouldn't work for you. I'm saying it's a waste of your time. I think you should be pursuing directing because you would be extraordinary at it and you're able to talk to everyone and every department. You can answer questions that quickly. I have no desire to direct. The idea of 50 people coming at me with questions is I'd rather bartend. No joke. I'd rather bartend.
I do. I am a little, it is a little daunting to me because I do enjoy the downtime that one enjoys as an actor.
You don't get that as a director.
You do not get that as a director. And I just would have to get used to that. But in the spaces when I have been a director, and I just said spaces like a fucking tool, but you know, in the times that I've been a director, that
you're not a tool.
I know.
You've never said anything to make you sound like a tool.
But anyway, but if I heard this, I'd be like, spaces, who are you? What are you, a yoga instructor? In the times that I've directed, I have truly enjoyed it. And it's been exciting. And there's like this kind of almost this feeling of beat the clock. Like, you know, we got 12 hours to do this thing. And it's like, then we're coming down. Oh, I got to adjust something. Oh, you know what? Let's just collapse these two scenes together kind of stuff. And that's thrilling to me. I do love that. So there's that. But also, too, mostly for me, you know, in my future, it's mostly my personal life. I recently got divorced and my kids are, you know, one's off into college. The other is going off to college soon. So there's a lot of blank slates in front of me that I just kind of, what's always worked for me in the past is just to be open and to be reactive and not, I've never, very rarely have I ever like forced something good into happening. I was there when it presented myself and I said, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Let's do that. You know,
that's the same. That's the same thing I've done that you, yeah. that you said earlier talking today. You were like, did you have a plan or did you just, and
yeah.
the answer is no, I just went with the wind and something looked good, and I was like, super.
I had a hunch, and that's because it's the same way I was. It's the same way I always was. I didn't, you know, I sat next to kids in improv class that wanted to be on SNL, and I don't have the temerity to think I'm going to be on SNL. You know, I just want to see what happens. This seems fun, you know.
Yeah. Well, we've been very fortunate because we didn't have a hope chest or, you know, make a vision board or whatever. We just were like, I'd like to do something that is interesting and I'm going to learn something. And if it pays me money, that would be delightful.
Right.
Let's see what comes.
I still, the number one thing I have, and I think I was inspired. My aunt was, you know, like when I was a kid, she was like my superstar. And in eulogizing her, I came up with the phrase, she insisted on having fun. And that's like,
wow, that's
kind of what I feel like, you know, that's, I'm always going to try and fit that in there. I'm always going to try and, you know, James Burroughs, the director.
Yeah.
He had, I found
his fun clause.
His fun clause.
I was just thinking that.
He had the guy, James Burroughs, the one of the best TV directors ever, and
Seinfeld,
probably ever will be. Yeah.
Big Bang Theory, Two and a Half Men, Cheers.
He had a fun clause, which was, ironclad, airtight. He said, he was the only arbiter of it. If I'm not having fun, I can walk out at any time. And he said,
I can walk out and take my crew. If I am not having fun. And that's how his deals were structured to shoot pilots.
He said he only imposed it once.
Yep.
And
I remember.
You can probably, you out there with some time on your hands, you could probably look up which show it was. The one in which Jim Burrows only worked for like half of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, yeah, have fun. That's the thing.
What's your sort of like what you've learned?
Like, what do you feel like is the kind of thing that you can share with people if they were to ask, like, what's the point of it all?
Oh, you know, I was thinking about this because I knew what your podcast was. I'm too busy cooking and watching Top Chef to listen to one. Forgive me.
Listen,
I love you.
Honey, I listen to Howard Stern. That's my
podcast.
Okay, great.
No, okay, great.
You know what I mean? I don't. People,
we like what we like.
The podcast world, I'm an old man. Like, you know, like I'm Milton Berle on YouTube. You know, it's not my thing. So I enjoy doing it, but you know. So anyway, go ahead.
But I was thinking about this. What have you learned? And I've been thinking about it. And I can think of in answering that, what have you learned, is I have learned that anything I've learned, my imparting it doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone has to learn everything as they learn it. There's no way, even for me to say, you know, gals, don't overpluck your eyebrows. You're going to overpluck your eyebrows and then you're going to have to figure it out. There's nothing anyone can say. The only things I could think of to tell you were two tips that I really enjoy. And they're like cleaning hacks. Like, otherwise I can't, there's nothing I can say. I can't say love yourself, cut yourself some slack. The things I've learned that have made my life better are all things that everybody has to learn on their own.
Yeah.
And you're going to fuck up. You're going to go to bed angry. You're going to say the wrong thing. Everyone is going to do something stupid because it's what we are as an animal. That's just the animal that we are. We're smart enough to create these extraordinary things and love and music and selflessness. And we're, you know, capable of wretched cruelty and manipulation. You know, so we're all going to fuck up. And there's nothing I can tell you that you could, except you sharpen scissors by cutting aluminum foil.
Wow.
Now, you also take the spots off your dishes in the dishwasher by crumpling up a ball of aluminum foil. So if you have aluminum foil, you can do two great things in one day. And I love those kitchen hacks. And that's the only thing I can think of. Hopefully someone will do that and be like, wow, this is great. I've just sharpened my scissors and my dishes look better. And I learned that from Padgett Brewster, because everything else you have to learn on your own.
You are so deep in the pocket of Reynolds Wrap. It's so obvious.
Oh, I wish. How do I get them to sponsor me?
Reynolds Wrap. Get at Padgett Brewster. You owe her money. That just Reynolds Wrap through the roof. Their sales.
Who has said the thing that they learned that has stuck with you the most? In your interviews.
Oh, boy.
Is there something someone said that you're like, oh, my God, you know what? That every week.
Just recently. I mean, there's been other ones, but it's like there's been so many that it's like, and also, quite frankly, like, there's people that I think I'd like to have them on the podcast. And then I have to look up and see, like, oh, right, they were here 2 years ago. Like, that's just the nature of my oily brain. Things slide right out of it. But Steve O from Jackass was just on, and he said something that about that the words enthusiasm or the word, and I'm going to get it wrong. Go listen to that episode. But he said that enthusiasm, like that those two words are like the roots are love and God. Like that somehow that in like that there is enthusiasm is like if you love, you know, if you put love out into the world, it's like it's sort of the source, the God source.
Godliness.
I'm saying it.
I understand what you're saying. It is getting the most profoundly close to enlightenment, probably, what is our universe capable of?
Right.
If we can, because we are capable of that. We are capable of make a choice with love as the outcome. And sometimes we're frail or angry or fearful but if you choose that, that would be as close to the evolution of our species as we can get.
And that maybe within that, I mean, and I'm not a religious person, but sort of maybe in that, like, because enthusiasm, you just think of it as like, oh, being a cheerleader or going to a sports game and going rah, rah. But it's like, no, it is life force. Mm-hmm. It is saying yes to everything. Mm-hmm. It is saying like, I will actively participate. Mm-hmm. I will look for the best. I will, you know, try real hard to push away the shit and to look towards the light. And that's pretty great, you know?
That
and
is
I mean
great.
And it's and I mean and of course it's complicated by, you know, there being 60 seconds in every minute and, you know, life being long.
Yeah, but it's
long,
a simple
you know.
Idea. It's a clear idea and not a mantra, but something you
can
think of.
Well, like to enshrine enthusiasm as mm-hmm. high as you would art or love or patriotism or bravery. Like it's something something for me who can be a bit of a downer. It's very meaningful, you know?
Golly, I don't think of you as a downer.
Stick around. You know, stick around. All right. Listen, this has been so much fun.
It really has. Thank you.
It wasn't even a podcast. It was just a chance to talk to one of my favorite people. And I love you so much, and I miss you, and I'm gonna fix that soon, now that the world's opening up. So Padgett Brewster, thank you so much, and thank all of you out there for listening, and I will be back next week, God willing.
Big, big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blair, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a-growin'?